Erin Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Our next guest is Brianna Clark Grogan. She's the author of 8 vegan cookbooks with over 22 years' experience. Among her previous titles are Nana's Italian Kitchen, Authentic Chinese Cuisine for the Contemporary Kitchen, the Almost No-Fat Cookbook, and the Fiber for Life Cookbook. She also developed the recipes for Dr. Neil Bernard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. A teacher, lecturer, and former newspaper columnist, you can see Brianna's blog at veganfeastkitchen.blogspot.com and her website at briannaclarkgrogan.com. Woo! I'm talking to Brianna Clark Grogan!
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm excited. I've been looking at your recipes for a very long time.
Well, that's good. So you have a little bit of an idea of what I do.
Oh, gosh, yes. In fact, one of my favorites is from the Nana's Italian Kitchen, the biscotti. That's such an easy and fabulous recipe.
And, it's something that I really like because it's not too sweet, but it's very festive, and you can do all kinds of variations on it, so it's a great holiday.
Right. You know, you mentioned that a few times in the World Vegan Feast Cookbook that we're going to talk about today, but you mentioned this thing about some baked goods or sweet goods being too sweet, and I totally agree with you.
Well, you have a bit of an overload at the holidays anyway.
Yeah, especially. We're frequently invited to a vegan cookie party, and, oh, God, total sugar overload.
Yes.
It's just painful. But I don't like very sweet desserts, and that's one of the great reasons why we should all be getting in our kitchens and making stuff the way
that's
we
right.
like it.
That's for sure.
One of the things I like about the end of the year holidays more than the rest of the year is I think people get into the kitchen a little more, or they find their kitchens.
And, I hope so.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of talking more about some of the cookbooks that have recently come out specifically for this holiday period. And it's funny, when I look at your name and I see all of this information that's on your website and in your books, I think of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which to me was like the premier of all kinds of information, encyclopedia information. And I think if there was ever going to be an encyclopedia of vegan food, it would be the Encyclopedia Brianna, something like that.
Oh, thank you. My husband calls me an information junkie, and I also run a branch of a library, small library.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I can't help myself.
Right. No, that's a good thing. And you say this book is really for everyone, and it's for anyone who wants to dig into it, but it's for people that really want the detail because you go into it.
Well, I figure if you put the detail there for people that want to know, it's there. If they really don't care, they don't have to read it. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But my first editor I worked on many, many years ago on La Leche League cookbook. And she told me to write the recipes and remember that most of the people, or some of the people, will know nothing. So you have to write for those people. And then the people that are more experienced will just sort of gloss over the details. But I think that was really good advice, and I always remember that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I read this thing once about cookbooks, which I think is unfortunate, that people that get them maybe try one or two recipes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep saying, read it from cover to cover. Read the entire book like a book. And then use it.
Exactly. I'm just going to give an example, a recent example, and I won't mention the name of it, but there was one new cookbook that came out, and I glanced through it, and it was okay. I thought nothing really jumped out at me. But then I had to do a review of it, and when I actually dug into it, I was just floored by the writing style and the ingenuity. You know, a quick glance doesn't always do it justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing about cookbooks. Certainly, if you have a big budget behind you, you can make it really a work of art in terms of photographs and
mm-hmm.
color. And that does not guarantee that it's a good cookbook.
Oh, that's for sure. I have, you know, hundreds of cookbooks, probably over 500, and many, probably most of the ones that I use the most don't even have photographs in them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's get to the meat of this.
Well, meat is not a bad word. You can have nut meat.
That's
and grain
right.
meat and all kinds of meat.
Actually, I like that. I may reuse that. Meat is not a bad word.
The field roast people.
Okay. So you go into the first bunch of recipes are the essentials, where you talk about a number of soy foods, tofu, and seitan, which is a wheat gluten product, and how you make them. You know, as you talked about the people who are into cooking who would gloss over some of this, you know, I read it and I thought, oh, I didn't think of that. And so sometimes even people that are very experienced in cooking, when they read someone else's perspective, are still going to pick up something. So I
oh,
say
definitely.
Read.
You're talking about World Vegan Feast now, my new
I'm
book,
talking
right?
about World,
yes.
yes, you are the yeah. author of 8 cookbooks, and now we're talking about your most recent one, World Vegan Feast.
Well, I'm still learning, and I've been cooking since I was a little girl, and I just love to discover new things. And you don't, you know, you can never know everything. So you're right. It's you really should, you know, pay attention to some of the stuff in the introductions and the basics in cookbooks, because you often get, you know, really good ideas and things that you didn't know about and new ingredients and that sort of thing. So. I think it's important, but
new ingredients, and I wanted to talk about this. You mentioned in your book that you didn't think you were much of a baker when you were young, and you realized because your mom didn't bake much, and
mm-hmm.
and then you got into it and learned quite a bit. It's funny how we tend to stick with the foods that we grow up with, unless we make a real conscious effort to learn more and go outside of that comfort box.
Exactly, yeah.
And
yeah.
even as a vegan, you know, I learned a lot, but I still kind of stuck to the same vegetables and things that I grew up with, and it's been a little bit of an effort to consciously buy some other stuff until it becomes a routine.
Yes, I some people complain that they, you know, they don't have much variety or they don't like new things, and I just say, you know, maybe try something new once a week, you know, and then you can just learn to like some new favorites, because there's so much variety out there now, much more than there was when I was growing
yeah.
up. Although I grew up in California, it was a little bit more variety than, say, the Midwest at that time. But, yeah, just try something new every week, and you never know.
Yeah, go to the produce section and just pick out something you haven't used before.
Exactly.
Learn how to use it.
Or grains, you know, there's all these grains now that we had never heard of 20 years ago, and you know, you may not like all of them, but you may find some new favorites, and variety is nutritionally a good thing, and it's also the spice of life, as they say. So.
That's right. How about, I was surprised to read a little section in the beginning of a book about textured vegetable protein.
Mm-hmm.
And because you kind of dispelled some of the myths about it, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think it's you know, I've been around for a long time. There's been a lot of study on soy, and it really was one of the only meat substitutes we had back in the old days.
That's right.
But I think that there's been some misconceptions that people equate it with hydrolyzed vegetable protein,
mm-hmm.
which is not the same thing. And that is something that's used in small amounts in processed foods, but it's not the same thing as textured vegetable protein, which is basically just soy flour that's cooked and then extruded through certain size dyes to make different shapes or granules or whatever, and then dried.
Yeah,
so
I wonder how that got started, because I had heard it and really haven't used much since I heard that, although I didn't research it, but it's good to know that that's really all it is, just soy flour textured vegetable protein, because it's a great product that you can making that just about anything.
Yeah, it's a good thing to have in your cupboard for emergencies, too, you know, because all you have to do is add hot liquid to it, and you can make a hamburger substitute, or you can have the chunks or whatever. Yeah, I don't know exactly how that got started, but and there, I should add also that in the book I give resources for finding organic variety of textured vegetable protein, so anybody who's worried about that too, it is available.
Yeah, well, that is important for soy foods because there are those nasty genetically modified soybeans running around taking over the world.
Yeah, so it's getting easier, and with the internet, of course, you can, you know, get a lot of stuff online, and you know, if you and that sort of, you know, textured vegetable protein or soy protein is the same thing. Will keep for a long time if you keep it dry, and so, you know, if you can get a bunch of it online and just stash it in your cupboard for, you know, when you can. I like the chunks personally for stews and stir fries. They're really nice. And really, even when you're paying a little bit more for the organic, it's still less expensive than buying the little packages of the meatless strips that they have now, which are good, but they do tend to be a little bit expensive. So,
I don't have much patience for that excuse that it's too expensive, because, you know, in my opinion, what we put in our bodies should be top priority.
Well, that's true, but then there are some people that are on strict budgets, and they do have to think about that. So.
Especially now with the economy, yeah.
Yeah, so I like to, you know, think about that as well. But, you know, you can eat really well on a pretty low budget. It's just, I think, a matter of training. Some people just have not learned to cook. Learning to cook is the number one thing for saving money, actually.
Yep, find your kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. Not just for health, but for your budget, too. And it's fun. You know, it can be fun. It doesn't have to be a chore.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that you don't have to eat soy on a vegan diet.
No, exactly. You don't have to. And I try to incorporate soy-free options. And ever since my Known as Italian Kitchen, I've tried to do that in my cookbooks. I don't have any allergies myself, but I try to imagine being a vegan and not eating soy. And, you know, you can come up with lots of things, actually. It's not necessary. But it's not, I don't believe that soy is a bad thing either. I eat it daily.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I like it. Now, this book, World Vegan Feast, is 200 fabulous recipes from over 50 countries. And I'm just curious, you live on a little island in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been, do you travel a lot?
Not really.
That's what I had a feeling.
I live on a budget as well, and I when I do travel, it's usually to the States to visit family or friends. And but I do have an international background. My father was Peruvian and part Italian, and I'm just interested in everything all over the world. So I read constantly and about different cuisines, and try to be as authentic as I can, talk to people. I was lucky to have grown up in San Francisco and then later lived in Vancouver for many years, and those are really cosmopolitan cities with many, many, lots of cultural diversity.
I certainly love to travel, but the world is really at our fingertips now with the internet, and I live in New York City in Queens, and there are, I think, more languages spoken here than anywhere.
Yeah, maybe Toronto. That's pretty good.
But there are definitely neighborhoods that I go to here where I feel like I'm traveling internationally.
Exactly, yeah, and I think that's wonderful. The high school that I went to in San Francisco had every race and culture and religion that you could think of in it. It was just a real melting pot, and I think that was a really good experience.
Now, you started cooking before you were a vegan. So you have some culinary training from the conventional world.
Yeah, well, self-taught, actually. But, my mom says that I was cooking before I can remember. She says I used to pull up the stool and, you know, try to help her, and I think I cooked my first dinner, she said, at 6 or something like that. I can't remember.
Well, I think some people come to cooking just naturally, and other people really struggle with it. And that's why detailed cookbooks like this are good for those who are uncomfortable in the kitchen.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we all shouldn't be, and we need to put it back in our DNA.
Oh, that's for sure. I mean, you know, if you didn't know how to cook before, you'd starve, you know, like servants. So, but and I think it's really important for boys to learn to cook. And you know,
mm-hmm.
My son is a good cook. My stepsons are good cooks, you know, and there's no reason why, you know, they can't.
Now, do they cook like you? Do you have vegetarians in the family?
Some, not my son,
mm-hmm.
but although he likes what I cook him. One of my daughters, my children are all grown up, of course, and have their own families, but
mm-hmm.
my middle daughter is a vegan now, and two of her daughters are vegetarian, and my oldest granddaughter, who's 19, she became a vegetarian when she was 14.
Yeah, and it's funny how it works for some, but it doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah, well, I don't believe in proselytizing to my family. I just they know what I believe in, and I serve good food. And my husband wasn't a vegan when we got married, and I didn't ask him to be
mm-hmm.
one, but he liked my food. And about 10 years after, he said, "Well, I guess I'm a vegetarian."
I've heard that before. Waking up and, "Oh, I guess I'm a vegetarian." Well, why not? When you've got all this great food around you.
That's right. I mean, that's all that counts with him, if it tastes good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he felt better, and so now he was eating a local egg now and then, but he hasn't even done that for quite a long time. So,
did you come to this for ethical reasons?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I actually was one of the, you know, homesteading, you know, young people in the 1970s, and we had my first late husband and I had homestead and raised our own animals in a, you know, small way.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved to the island, we had a smaller place, and I didn't want to deal with that anymore. And then my husband died, and I had been sort of, I wasn't really very interested in food for the first time in my life for a little while, you know.
Sure.
And then I just, you know, I'd always sort of been interested in soy foods. I already knew how to make my own tofu and a sort of old-fashioned way of making seitan that I learned from a Seventh-day Adventist friend. And that always really interested me, so I think I was kind of on my way. And then I realized, you know, we had not bought meat at the store. We had only had our own produce and our own meat and eggs, and that was kind of something that we had decided to do. And I realized, you know, I was buying it from the store again, and I hadn't done that for years, and I decided, well, I don't want to buy it from the store. I don't want to ask somebody else to, you know, butcher this meat.
Do the dirty work.
And so I decided that the only thing to do was become a vegetarian. And then a few months later, I became a vegan because it just seemed to be the logical thing. And then John Robbins' book came out, Diet for a New America.
Yep.
I just read that all in one night, and that just solidified my decision. And that's when I started writing cookbooks, because there weren't very many good ones.
Because we needed them, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating the way the cuisine has developed over the last 30 years.
I mean, just this last year, how many books have come out? How many vegan cookbooks have come out?
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you felt about that.
Oh, I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, there's so many.
I mean, I'm in my 60s now, and I just, I'm so happy that there's this whole new generation of cookbook writers out there, because, you know, I'll probably want to retire at some point. And I might have a book or two left, but there's just so much out there. No, I think it's wonderful, and whenever I go to a conference or something, I think it's really great. All these cookbook authors to get together, and, you know, it's not competitive. We're supporting each other's books, and
right.
And yeah, just trying to get the word out there, and it's really a great atmosphere, I find.
Well, I really look forward to the day when seeing vegan cookbook is sort of redundant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, while most people have a whole bunch of non-vegan cookbooks, so why not a whole bunch of vegan cookbooks? You know?
Absolutely. Well, we know that they're the most popular books that are sold, cookbooks, and so, you know, we definitely need to make a bigger chunk of that.
Oh, yeah, and it's happening. It's definitely happening. And one thing I just want to put out there for people when they're discussing it with other people who might be a little bit, you know, not convinced. I have a good friend here on the island, Fireweed, and she's an animal rights activist, and she always points out that vegan food is not exclusive. It's inclusive because everybody can eat it.
Mm-hmm. I try it. It's for everyone, and it's good. It's
better than good.
I think there's more variety when you're cooking vegan.
I think so. I know people, I'm just always still amazed that people will say, oh, well, what do you eat? You know, you think that they've gotten over that by now, but...
I know.
But, you know,
there are more people doing it, and yet the questions remain the same.
Exactly. Exactly, the whole protein question and blah, blah, blah. But, no, I mean, honestly, I've said this before, but there's no way in my lifetime that I could possibly try not only all the recipes there are out there now, but just all the different combinations that I could think of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just not enough time. And that's pretty amazing, you know. And
I want to talk about chickpea flour for a minute.
Oh, okay.
I noticed you use it in some of your crepes and in your seitan, and I'm like nuts over chickpea flour.
You're not nuts over
it? I love it.
Oh, you love it.
I love it. It's crazy the properties that it has, what it's able to do.
I know. It's a wonderful thing, and I started using it because I used to use soy flour quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
and now some people have problems with that, so I was looking for a substitute, and I started using chickpea flour, and it works really well. But I also love it, the taste of it. I don't know if you've ever tried the farinata recipe in Nona's Italian Kitchen.
I don't remember, but I will have to go back to it.
It's a chickpea pancake. It's an Italian peasant dish. It's all the rage in a lot of restaurants now, and it's just a flat kind of It's chickpea flour and water that you soak, and it's got a little salt and garlic, and you can put herbs in it, and they eat it as an appetizer. But it has so much flavor.
And yeah, it's crazy.
It hasn't got anything in it, you know?
Well, I kind of discovered chickpea flour. I'm not gluten. I don't have celiac disease. I think I have some issues with wheat where it gives me a headache, but I'm not convinced. But I just started going... limiting my wheat and discovering all the other flours just because it just opens the door to so many different flavors and textures and things.
Yeah.
And I just got nuts with the chickpea flour. It's just amazing. Soca and putting it in a bake, it's just great, and it's good for you.
Yes, so farinata is sort of the Italian version of soca.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Italians would tell you that soca is the French version of the farinata.
Everybody feels.
It's from the same area, though, in the Mediterranean area, you know. So you know what I'm talking about. I know, it's a wonderful thing. And in Indian, it's easy to get in Indian groceries. It's called besan, B-E-S-A-N.
Right.
They use it in a lot of their pancakes and things like that, too. So, I always have a big bag of it in the house.
Well, I love the Indian groceries, too, because you find lots of different beans and flour that you don't see anywhere else.
Oh, yeah. I know. We're lucky, actually, in our area, there's a large East Asian population, and it's really easy to get even in the smallish town that we shop in supermarkets. You can get, you know, black lentils and, you know, all these kinds of dal that you wouldn't expect to find.
Now, you say you live on an island, but there is access to different kinds of food there, but
on the island, although we do have some farmers that grow vegetables in the summer, but we're just a 10-minute ferry ride from Vancouver Island, and
mm-hmm.
then it's a 15-minute ride up to the nearest town, which is about 30,000.
Sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, it is. It's quite beautiful. It's really worth some of the inconvenience living here. You just learn how to do big shopping.
But for people that don't have access to lots of different foods, this is where the internet comes in.
Exactly, and that's why I tried to put as many resources in the back of the book as I could, and also make that for Canadians and internationals as well as Americans. It was, of course, more available in the United States, but I don't get a lot of stuff online, but there's some things that I have to buy online, and I'm really grateful for that.
The thing is, you can get dried beans anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're probably one of the best foods. They're inexpensive, and you can do so many different things with them. And there might be people that have allergies to some of the beans. I know fava can be a problem, but for the most part, beans are pretty safe.
Yes, they are, and they're, again, something that will last for quite a long time if you store them properly. I always feel safe, you know, if we have beans and rice in the house, which we always do. You know, you could live on beans and rice. You could try a new recipe from every country every day for beans and rice, or beans and another grain if you want to change it. And I've thought of writing a book on that, actually.
Well, one of the things that I like is you really can tell in this book that you know what you're talking about, that you've been there and you've done it many, many, many times. I mean, you can read that in here, which is helpful. And I also like the tone, especially when you talk about preparing beans and you talk about the way different people do it. But the bottom line is, you know, just do it the way you want.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted people to know that, you know, some of the rules that we hear about aren't really true, and so why should that limit us, you know? Whatever way is convenient for you or you think it works out better for you, then, you know, there's really not a wrong way. There's just different ways.
There's also a great discussion in here about egg substitutes, and I think it's probably the best that I've seen in terms of egg substitute discussions. You really break down what we use eggs for, the different properties, and then how substitutes can fill a particular need.
Yeah, I think that's important because I had quite a few failures in my early days, as we all have, I'm sure.
Yeah, failures are fine, and sometimes it leads you to something new.
Exactly. It's a learning experience. So when I thought about it, I thought, okay, well, eggs do so many different things, so one egg substitute probably isn't going to do the trick all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, it might be useful for other people who are, because I want also this to inspire people to do their own recipes. So the more knowledge you have, the better you'll be at that.
I like using ground flax seeds a lot in water, number one, because flax seeds are so good for us,
mm-hmm.
and because you get that gooey consistency. But I never strain them, and I read in your list of egg substitutes that you can kind of strain the seeds out.
You can. I don't usually do that. And when I want a really light color, I just use the golden flax seeds.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't make things brown. But I think, you know, if you're straining it, you're probably getting some of the fiber out of there, and I like to leave as much fiber as I can in there.
Yeah, I'm kind of a believer that the food should be good for you, nutritious, and taste good, and look good. And for a long time, a lot of cuisine didn't consider the health, and so a lot of chefs will peel things and strain things and leave them all the stuff that's good.
Exactly, yeah, like the tomatoes, I think I mentioned that somewhere about not taking the seeds out of tomatoes. They found actually now that the seeds and the gel around the seeds contains a lot of the flavor of tomatoes.
Right.
So why should we get rid of them? I've always, you know, maybe it's laziness, but I never did that.
I know, me either, and they're good for you, and we really need to change that negative attitude about leaving the healthy parts of food in the recipes.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Anyway, it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday.
Yes, you too. Well, I know I'm going to be digging into this book and making some really fun things. So thank you.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, you too. That was Brianna Clark Grogan, and check out her website. Very informative. Lots of great things at BriannaClarkGrogan.com. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.